on engineering and transportation aspects of Northern Petroleum development. If you're interested in social sciences, you won't want to stay here. I want to make an announcement before we begin the panel discussion this afternoon. I want to announce that there are messages and mail at the reception desk in the lobby of the Bunnell building, and that is this building. So if you're expecting mail, also might check for messages, can be done there. Large-scale transportation into the Arctic regions of Alaska has very, very suddenly burst on the scene. The Fairbanks International Airport, in a span of less than a year, has jumped from a quiet, sleepy atmosphere to being the world's leading airport in the handling of air cargo. Whether we agree or disagree on the construction methods and the effects on the environment of the Walter J. Hickel Highway, that road is certainly a significant sign of the times, and its construction was a considerable construction feat. Humble Oil is involved in a $30 million plus experiment, which, when successful, will probably lead to the construction of many 250,000-ton ice-breaking tankers. This, in addition to being a boon to the North, will also be a boon to the U.S. shipping industry. Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which is now moving into the initial phases of construction, heralds the beginnings of immense pipelines in the North. Tremendous tonnages of material and equipment are pouring down the Mackenzie by barge and from Seattle by barge to the oil exploration areas of the North. U.S. Department of Transportation is suddenly very much interested in a transportation corridor, including railroads, highways, and so on, to the Arctic part of Alaska. All of these developments of the past year, they're developments of a single year, indicate change in the North in the areas of transportation. And now I want to introduce the first of the panel members here. We have four speakers who will discuss various phases of Arctic engineering and Arctic transportation. The first speaker is Dr. Hal Payton. Dr. Payton's education consists of Bachelor of Science and Master of Science degrees in Civil Engineering from Oregon State University. He attended the University of Minnesota as an NSF Science Faculty Fellow for a year, has a PhD in engineering from the University of Alaska. Hal came to Alaska with the Corps of Engineers in 1953 and remained with the Corps for 2 years. He then came to the university in 1955 as an instructor in civil engineering. He swung more heavily into research in the later 50s and has had a sort of a split teaching research appointment at the university for the past 12 years. This last year, the consulting pressures have become very extensive, and in July he left the university on a leave of absence and is now consulting full-time. He is still on a fractional, very small fractional appointment with the university. During his 12 years of research and teaching at the university, he's published a number of papers, some in the open literature, quite a number of in-house reports, and several papers at various meetings of one sort or another dealing with northern activities and northern engineering. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Hal Payton.
Thank you, Chairman Buckey. Today I am going to deviate a bit from the average paper, I suspect, at a science conference and select a single example or environmental aspect anyhow to look at rather than all of Arctic engineering, and pursue with some penetration the optimization processes involved in a single area. I could have used, for instance, sea ice. We've constructed the Cook Inlet drilling platforms and the docks in Cook Inlet, the Manhattan is sailing, the mooring and loading facility at Prudhoe or on the North Coast someplace is being pursued. We could have talked about ice fog and the problems of underway now, for instance, in siting the Atlantic Richfield refinery in the Fairbanks area. We could talk about the problems associated with drilling oil wells through the permafrost mantle and the problems associated with that. I've selected, however, to talk about primarily permafrost, not because there's anything particularly magic about permafrost. Everyone's interested in it right now, but a great number of you are well versed in permafrost and what the problems are. But I want to show three things. One is that many of the environmental factors regarding permafrost are well known. Excuse me. Two, the calculations are possible and performance is predictable. And number three, that optimization processes are certainly available to us now, not sometime in the future, but now, and that we indeed, and you indeed, I should say, many of you being with the industry, are pursuing these optimization processes now. I've selected some few slides to go through this process with you and with respect to permafrost. And if I could have the first slide, please. The thermal regime which creates permafrost, I think most of us are quite familiar with, but just to start off, we'll go through a slight refresher course in which we see plotted temperature versus depth here, and the amplitude of seasonal variation at the top is indicated. The dotted line shows the extrapolation of the geothermal gradient to the Earth's surface. Now, in the summertime, when the soil gets warm, it gets above 32 degrees, we thaw the ground annually, have an active layer, and then where, again, the geothermal gradient crosses the 32-degree temperature, we have thawed material from there clear on through to the center of the Earth. And the permafrost mantle, then, is that's in always below 32 by the definition we're using. I should hasten to add that all materials below 32 are not necessarily frozen, especially those that aren't, that have high saline contents in the soil water, and also very fine grain soils, particularly the montmorillonite clays, which are not frozen at 32. Someplace you have to make an arbitrary definition, and 32 degrees is frequently made. Next slide, please. The problems are most generally associated with how we change the soil surface conditions when we do something, whether it be build a road, run a tractor out across the tundra, build a highway, an airfield, put a heated building on it, or almost anything. And one of the things that happens is simply an increase in seasonal amplitude at the surface. In other words, we plow the snow off in the winter and it gets colder in the winter, and we either slow down evaporation or something of this sort and have higher surface temperatures in the summertime. The mean annual soil surface temperature, the average temperature, is not changed a bit, but we see that indeed we thaw a bit of the permafrost from the surface down simply by having an increase in surface amplitude. Next slide, please. Another thing that we frequently do, as an example, road construction or airfield construction, is to increase the mean annual soil surface temperature. And we see here the effect of increasing the average temperature being a thawing the permafrost from the top and also thawing it from the bottom if the extent of coverage where we've changed this temperature is very large. Obviously, a road over deep permafrost isn't going to thaw all that this slide shows on the bottom side. Next slide. When we superimpose both of these, and these are rather heavy disturbances I've shown here, but we have an increase in surface amplitude and an increase in average temperature, and we have thawed all of the permafrost under our facility. Next slide, please. Now, one of the problems associated with almost any optimization process or any design process in dealing with frozen soils has to do with what the original condition was. We saw in the previous three slides that had it been a lot colder, we wouldn't have melted all of the permafrost, for instance. And we see these are mean annual air temperatures across Alaska, and virtually this entire map is underlain by at least sporadic and sometimes continuous permafrost. But we can see just from air temperatures, for instance, from something below 10 to about 30 degrees within permafrost regions, that the temperature of the permafrost itself is going to have extreme variability and at a critical point, which is right at the melting point of water. Next slide, please. Now let's see a few examples of what a standard disturbance does at different latitudes as we start on the north coast and then go southward into the through the Fairbanks area here, for instance, and even further in the Copper River Valley, where if we had an original mean annual soil surface temperature of 14 degrees and we increased the annual temperature by just the slight amount of 2 degrees and increased the amplitude by the slight amount of 2 degrees, which gives us on the hottest end an increase of only 4 degrees Fahrenheit, we can see on the first line, for instance, that the original active layer for this particular condition and this particular vegetative mat was 1.5 feet. And we change that to 2.2 feet, or we increase the active layer by 0.7 feet. If that was all ice, that means we have a settlement of a little over 0.5 foot, just from this very small temperature disturbance. The original permafrost thickness was 898 feet, and we reduced it 100 feet with this very small change if it was over a great expanse. These sorts of changes can be incurred by changing drainage patterns, for instance. Rather than put a fill on, all you got to do is drain the water off, and you can either add or subtract changes of this sort. As we go farther and farther south, we see on the last one, for instance, where we have 30 feet of a 30 degree mean annual soil surface temperature, that this very modest little disturbance that we cause eventually thaws out all of the permafrost. It's not a big disturbance, it's a very small one. But the sensitivity, as we go from the north coast down through past Sagwan, into the Brooks Range, down through Bettles, Fairbanks Country, down through the Copper River Valley, as the pipeline is going, as an example, the thermal conditions are radically different. Next, please. Now, one of the concepts which is used a lot for preserving permafrost, if that's what we want to do, as an example, under roads and airfields, and being done all the time on the North Slope right now, is that we can add a fill such that we can, even though by adding the fill, we've done both things. We've increased the mean annual soil surface temperature, and we've increased the amplitude of seasonal variation. We can design a fill such that the new temperature envelope intersects the top of the permafrost right at 32 degrees.
Right at that location.
And this sort of a design is calculable. As an example, precisely this was done at the at Prudhoe Bay for the first airstrip, the extension on the airstrip, all the pads, all the roads within the Humble Arco operation are designed on this basis, such that the permafrost is retained in its original state, even though we've changed the surface condition. Next slide, please. Now, as we go from north to south, though, we begin to run into troubles. And let's look at this particular example, and where we have a mean annual soil surface temperature in the disturbed condition of 20 degrees, in an amplitude of 20 degrees. We have a fill of gravel on frozen gravel, takes on a subgrade material of frozen gravel, takes 4.85 feet
You can never calculate it to three significant figures, but I leave them in there just to demonstrate. That fill requirement, this exact same location with this exactly the same fill material, but in which we have an icy silt subgrade instead of a frozen gravel subgrade, requires almost twice the fill thickness. So number one axiom comes out that a 5-foot fill to accomplish something, as we have here on frozen gravel, doesn't do the same thing on an icy silt. As a matter of fact, it'll fail, and it will fail dramatically. So there is, number one, no regional answer on what thickness of fill you can use. Secondly, in this slide, shows that if we come further south to where we had, let's say, a 32-degree, looking at the bottom one now, if we originally had a 32-degree mean annual soil surface temperature and we increase it to 35 by construction, that our fill requirement, it becomes infinite. There is no way in which we can add fill or insulations, be it polyurethane or anything else, to preserve the permafrost if the mean annual soil surface temperature exceeds 32 degrees. Next slide, please. Now, this shows the effect of using an insulation, in this particular case, right out of one of Dr. Lockenbrook's publications, and where we use a fill with gravel, and we find this is a fairly warm condition, with a two-layer case using gravel on the subgrade, which was on frozen silty clay, takes a fill of 13.5 feet. If we add 1 foot of corduroy, we cut this down to a gravel fill requirement of 6.2 feet. That corduroy can be made of anything. We can use man-made insulations, or like plastic foam insulation, or we can use the material from a clearing. As an example, in road construction practice in Canada, is quite often that the clearing material, rather than being chipped and spread around, is simply humped up underneath the gravel fill, and the gravel fill is reduced substantially. This doesn't work in all cases, depending on soil strength problems and the loads that have to be carried and on, but it certainly reduces the amount of gravel. Now, one of the points here is that the difference between north and south is dramatic, and the difference of the materials with which you're working, be they those in the subgrade or be they those in the fill, are very important. I think it can be almost categorically stated that south of the Brooks Range, like road construction or railroad construction or airfield construction, cannot be accomplished, which retains the permafrost in a frozen state. This is simply because the mean annual soil surface temperature is above 32 degrees with construction below this latitude. This means that without artificial refrigeration, a great many of our facilities south of the Brooks Range simply must accept permafrost melt as part of the design criteria. Unless we're prepared to pay the price for artificial refrigeration. This means then also, as we've seen all over Fairbanks, Eielson Air Force Base, Fort Wainwright, locations on the campus here, the roads all around the area, that permafrost melt does occur and is irrevocable. Next slide, please. Examples of installations in cold regions north of the Brooks Range include this main dew line station at Barrow, in which the gravel fills are performing beautifully. Again, the design, just like we talked on the previous slides, and designed specifically by that technique, they work very well. Next slide, please. A very old installation which is working well, not only because the fill requirements were met, but also because of the nature of the soils under the area, is the airfield at Umiat, which is performing beautifully to this date, even though constructed two decades ago. I'm not showing any current work on the North Slope, primarily to show the long-term effects. These are very old installations and are performing beautifully. Next, please. We have members in the audience who are sitting in the weasel, but this is a similar small disturbance which has inadequate insulation on it now, and the permafrost melt can be high if the soil's under, is the permafrost melt can be deep, and the disturbance can be undesirable, certainly, if the soils underneath have a high enough ice content. In other words, if the material, when thawed, loses its strength, and when the settlement occurring from this is excessive, as in this case. Next, please. A similar example where not only we see thermal erosion, as we saw on the previous one, but also superimposed on the thermal erosion is hydraulic erosion. And we see in this slide a cut near Umiat, which is approximately 50 feet deep. Erosion of this sort not only is a problem in a construction area, but is very much a problem in traversing the country at a later time. And erosion of any sort, most generally, is unacceptable even for investment purposes, irrespective of aesthetics and conservation and whatnot. Next, please. In the south, for instance, we don't have to remove the vegetation, as was shown in the area shown north. Both of those previous slides were north of the Brooks Range. This is a slide taken in the Fairbanks area in which we can see all sorts of little melt areas showing up, especially in this area and some up above, in which reforestation was, or revegetation was accomplished in the process of the farming itself. In the Fairbanks area, removing the vegetation, cultivating the land, and replanting it back to perennial plants such as heavy grasses and this sort of thing is too much of a disturbance, and permafrost melt is triggered and will continue almost indefinitely. Next slide, please. This shows again the sensitivity between north and south. Other problems associated with the materials, we're going to take a look at ice contents in soils now, is a location like this one in which a heated building was placed on a high ice content soil. Part of the structure is heated and part of the structure is not heated. The permafrost under the port section isn't thawed nearly as badly as that off to the under the main part of the cabin. These sorts of settlements can be calculated. The amount of heat, the amount of thaw under such a structure can be calculated with pretty good precision. Next slide. And we look at an example in which I think is of interest. Let's say this is a tank. We might think of it in terms of a crude oil tank, a large one, 250 feet in diameter, on the north slope. The original soil temperature at the surface, mean annual temperature, 15 degrees. The oil in the tank at 100 degrees, and the thermal properties of the soil indicating a sandy gravel. And a temperature disturbance now 15 minus 100, 85 degrees Fahrenheit. That is our thermal disturbance. Next slide, please. We can now calculate, for instance, the time rate of change under the, this happens to be under the center of the tank, but what the temperature change with time after construction at various depths under any part of the tank we want to calculate. And I've plotted two curves here, one for 50 feet under the tank and one for 100 feet under the tank, and we see that the little ticks over on the right where it says 50 feet alongside the tick, that's the equilibrium condition. In other words, even 50 feet under the tank, 20 years after construction, we're still about 5 degrees from equilibrium. If that happened to be right at the melting point, that would mean that 20 years from now, we would begin melting at that depth. We can see at 100 feet under the tank, for instance, we're farther from equilibrium. And it takes a long, long time for this hot tank to thaw the material, if that's what we want to do. The only point here is, really, that these things are calculable and they can be designed in a rational basis. Next. Looking at ice content, we see this sort of terrain all over the North Slope. This happens to be very nearly the very near the Colville River. Polygonal pattern ground is, I think, standard terminology for everybody working in the Arctic now. I won't pursue it. Next slide, please. But if we look at this polygonal pattern ground now in a sketch form, the geometry is roughly accurate for most of them we find. Next slide, please. We then find the ice concentrations under these polygonal patterns roughly by this sketch, plus many, many ice lenses generated by a different mechanism. And superimposed on this, we can have very great ice masses we encounter to substantial depths. Recent exploration shows that we have many square miles in the White Hills with ice more than 40 feet thick, with nothing but about 6 inches of vegetative material on the surface. Continuous, persistent ice mass. So we have generally the three kinds of ice which give us problems: the ice wedges, the ice lenses, and these massive ice formations. Next, please. Ice wedge looks something like this. They vary greatly in size, but can constitute up to about 50% by volume the soil under the ground surface as pure ice. If we thaw this, we have problems. At least we have a lot of water melted and running away with very low soil strengths in most soils. Next, please. Problems of this sort are generated with the melting of high ice content silts. This thaw is only down about a foot or a little less than a foot, but the supersaturated mineral soil that's left is not the best thing to construct on. Next. Similarly, we can look at different kinds of soils which don't have all of this ice in it, and looking at it in a frozen condition, this taken at Barrow, underground, and the all of the ice you see in this, most of it anyhow, is a frost from inside. Next, please. Now, looking at a particular project to get a little better feel for all of the problems involved in an optimization solution, we see that the pipeline transects the entire state from the very, very cold Arctic through the Brooks Range into the through the central lowlands, which are high temperature permafrost, through the Alaska Range, down through the Copper River Basin, which has very high temperature permafrost, and finally into the Chugach Mountains, where there is essentially no permafrost. But the line contains permafrost north from the Chugach. But it ranges from a very low temperature permafrost to a very high temperature permafrost. Next. If we use as an example now three alternate routes for the pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to just south of Bettles, this is just the northern end. The one on the left is the one through Anaktuvik Pass, the one in the middle is the Tulik River route, and the one on the right is the Sagavanirtok route. Now, if we're going to build a pipeline, we can see that primarily the ice content of the soil is that which is causing us problems. If we can find permafrost, which essentially is a dry gravel that doesn't have any water in it, doesn't have any ice in it, then disturbances to this cause us very little problem, if any. Conversely, if we go through materials such as where we saw the big ice wedge, made with fine-grained silts with very high ice contents, disturbances to this sort of material will cause us very serious problems, or can. Now, a great part of looking at a project of this sort then has to do with soil selection. What kind of soils are where, and how do we and how can we adjust routes on the basis of soil's quality? Well, let's look at the next slide. If we set an arbitrary definition that ice contents which exceed the natural void volume, in other words, it's going to settle some when we thaw it out, if we call those ice-rich soils, and if we thaw them out and we don't have any significant settlement, We call those ice poor soils. And if we set an arbitrary definition right now, just for the optimization process, that we're going to call it a good route if we don't have any ice rich soils deeper than 10 feet. In other words, in this case, we might say, although this isn't the way the pipeline is necessarily being constructed, but we could say that we could dig a ditch 10 feet deep and put the pipeline on a good foundation, even though we might melt some stuff above it, which is ice poor. But the pipeline is bedded on a very stable foundation. Now, looking at the analysis of these three routes with this concept in mind, let's look at the next slide. And we look at the Anaktuvik route, in which we have about a foot of silty ice. We have down to 15 feet pure ice, about a half a foot of silty ice, and pure ice continuing on down through at least the 20-foot level at the bottom of the hole. This is representative of a great part of the Anaktuvik route. This particular borehole, it happens to be where it would have to cross through the White Hills. The Tulik route, for instance, has a little bit of silty ice on top, some pure ice, silty ice, and icy silt. And we have almost pure ice down to 15 feet and roughly 50% ice by volume below that, at least to the bottom of this borehole. On the Sag River route, in this same 50-mile stretch that we're talking about here, for direct comparison purposes, the material was frozen gravel with no excess ice to the bottom of the hole. And these are representative. I don't mean to say these are three separate holes, but there are many, many boreholes in each of these routes which generate this picture. These three are exact replicas of the borehole log, but they're representative of much longer stretches than that. It now becomes obvious that if we're going to disturb the Anaktuvik route in this section, we're going to have enormous problems. The same thing's true of the Tulik route, but isn't true of the Sagan of Anaktuvik route. Next slide, please. Now, pursuing this a bit further and looking at all three routes that were shown on the map to mile 300, each little vertical tick mark represents a borehole that was made last spring by Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And the red lines indicate, on the basis of this comparison that we just went through, that type of comparison, what the poor soils were compared to the good soils. We've made an arbitrary definition of good and bad. And we see that the Sagan of Anaktuvik route has very little as compared to either the Tulik or the Anaktuvik route. I think past this point, there has been a substantial improvement in the Sagan of Anaktuvik route for those sections which have poor soils by more detailed analysis. But it's this sort of optimization that has allowed us now to, as Mr. Henderson will talk about, select routes. Next slide, please. As an example, these comparisons are the Sag versus Anaktuvik. We can show poor versus good. Next slide, please. We actually come up with numbers now for evaluation. The Sag versus a Tulik route, we see we have a substantial improvement. Next slide, please. Now, we have two alternates for design, for instance. This has been talked about quite a bit. These are examples, not necessarily directly associated with the pipeline, but show that if we run hot oil down the line, or warm oil, like on the right over there, if the oil is 40 degrees Fahrenheit, we have a thaw area like this, which means that everything below the pipe now has to have low ice content soil, or we'll have problems with the pipe. And as the oil temperature gets hotter and hotter, the area of thaw gets larger and larger. And we have the capability of calculating all this. We know what the rate of thaw is, how much the thaw is going to be, what the settlement's going to be, what the pipe bending might be, and this sort of thing. In other words, again, matching pipeline performance now to the soil properties and the thermal properties, we can actually optimize the design for the best secure situation for the pipeline. Next. The elevated sections in the poor soils, not necessarily those we've defined here for this demonstration, but what might be on some other basis be called poor soils in hot permafrost have to be constructed something like this. I hear a lot in the paper and in chatting with people about how nice the road is going to be alongside the pipeline when it's built, and it turns out that in the warm permafrost areas, we can't build a road adjacent to the pipeline because the road itself will thaw the permafrost. So it's going to have to look something like this in elevated sections. We cannot construct a road without artificial refrigeration adjacent to the pile bent for the pipeline without thawing the piles out. Next, please. Well, I think the demonstration is that by, number one, understanding the environment, permafrost is a great big word, and it covers many, many kinds of materials. We can find materials which are below 32 degrees but don't have any ice in them, or below 32 degrees with an enormous amount of ice. And depending on which of these soils we find, we can do different sorts of things. We find also that a great number of the calculations can indeed be made. Now, in closure, I would like to make a couple of comments. I suspect this is the proper place. And that is that as engineers, the optimization process and coming up with the best solution has been a heritage of ours. And not only in areas of whether a beam is going to break when we load it up or whether the airplane is going to fly or not, but also in areas where we now call them conservation and we now call them ecology. Problems of erosion have been long-standing problems and have been coped with for a long time. One of the things I see happening right now is that we have, rightfully, many, many people unfamiliar with optimization processes and optimum designs of an entire system who are doing their very best to assure that we don't damage something that we hadn't thought of. In the case, we talk about the word ecology all the time, we talk about conservation and all of these things. The individuals who are speaking to these to these problems are rightfully concerned. This is one of the last frontiers, and this is one of the areas where these concerns should be addressed. I don't think any of us would argue to that. But we do find that what they consider optimum within their narrow little confines, for instance, a fish man or a plant man or some a wildlife man of some sort, sees within his narrow confine his optimum and then sells it very hard. And I wonder at times if these people realize the muscle they have, because they can drive solutions to their optimum which are not a system optimum at all. As an example, if we have people interested in the streams say you can't build a road within 1,000 feet of a stream because it might damage the stream, and in that shift of 1,000 feet, you sell that 1,000-foot shift because of the stream, and you force the road to be built on very unstable soils, then that isn't the best answer. And I think that it's very important as we pursue this next year that we all talk to each other and we take no hard positions until all of us understand all of the problem. Now, this is impossible. We can't all understand all of the problem. But I do think we want to be very careful about, I guess it means not realizing how much muscle you have. And we see it happen not only in the cases of our engineering problems here in the state at this time, but we see a very small group of students tear up entire universities. For some reason right now, we're receptive to small vocal groups having enormous influence. And I don't think we want to see our development go that way.
Thank you, Hal. I would ask that you submit written questions at the end of the symposium, please. The next speaker on our program this afternoon is Mr. Leland E. Wilson, who is the District Production and Drilling Superintendent for Atlantic Richfield in Anchorage. Mr. Wilson's topic is going to be operational logistics, and I'm sure that anyone who has operated more than about 2 miles from town can appreciate operational logistics. And if you've operated in the North Slope, particularly if you're trying to do so from Anchorage or from Fairbanks, you really appreciate it. Mr. Wilson was graduated with a BS in Petroleum Production Engineering from Telsey University in 1950. He began with Atlantic Richfield in 1950 and has been with Atlantic Richfield in Texas, Louisiana, Libya, and various other places since. He came to Alaska first in 1964. He owes allegiance to professional organization, the AIME. I want to introduce this time Mr. Wilson.
Thank you. In any speech about logistics, we have to first speak of the items to be transported. I, too, like to hide behind slides, so I think we should have the first slide. This will give you an idea of some of the logistical problems, some of the equipment and supplies that has to be hauled into the North Slope. This is by no means is all of it. There are many other construction items. This particular drilling rig here is a new one. There are two, just a pair of them alike up there. We're contracted for by Atlantic Richfield and Humble. This is a Rowan Drilling Company rig capable of about 16,000 feet. It's unique in that it is designed for a helicopter. That is, the entire rig can be broken down into 20,000-pound packages. You can see around the area, though, the many other necessary supplies of lumber, fuel, mud, cement, casing, even groceries. Fuel is another major logistical item. That drilling rig we looked at on a cold day can burn 5,000 gallons a day. I forgot to mention it is a turbine-powered rig. So, fuel is one of the things that we have to move around a lot. One of the standard methods when we have roads available is use of a truck and these fuel tanks. The fuel is flown in and then transported around by the trucks. Here's another shot of these pillow tanks. These are 50,000-gallon tanks, and the trucks are typical of the kind used on the North Slope for transportation, large Kenworths and that type. One of the most expensive problems we found in the winter time is moving rigs from location to location. Just this year, we have tried a new, not an old method, but a new one to the North Slope, the use of these athy wagons. Steel beams are strung through windows in the substructure of the rigs, and then they're, with hydraulic jacks, they are jacked up onto these wagons. But this means we can move the entire rig, even with the drill pipe and the derrick, over long distances without dismantling it. This is a scene last year when we were moving one of these rigs with four cats out in front, and you can see the athy wagons. There are four of them around the rig. And with the four cats leading, we were able to move 26 miles and at a speed of about 1.5 miles per hour, which is pretty fast. This resulted in a savings of almost 3 weeks of the usual time taken to lay the derrick down and break it down into small pieces to haul overland by truck or cat train. This is a rather poor picture, but that is a cat train. This is a very practical way to move, and one of the oldest means of moving material across the Arctic. But it is expensive, and probably much more expensive than you would think. It's, at times, though, the only way that we can actually move. Dr. Payton went into the road construction. This permanent road, typically 30 feet wide, 5 foot thick, are designed so that they will not melt the tundra underneath the gravel. With the permanency of development operations, we'll see quite a few of these permanent roads carefully planned through the area. These roads are also quite expensive and cost well over $200,000 a mile, depending on how far you are from the gravel source. Fortunately, we have good gravel supplies in most of the rivers of the North Slope. Now come to a slide which is typical of last winter's crush of materials at the local airport. This shot shows many of the loads of mud, supplies, and equipment which accumulated at Fairbanks during the big push last winter. Here's another picture of this equipment. This happens to be a drilling rig and its components. This is a view from the control tower showing a lineup of four Hercs. As you probably know, these planes are capable of carrying 50,000 pounds of cargo or fuel and have a large outsized cargo area and have proved ideal for operations between Fairbanks and the North Slope. This is a shot of some piling being loaded on the Hercules here at Fairbanks. And some other cargo being offloaded after flying to the North Slope. Typically, these trips are 175 to $275 a ton, depending on how much you can get on the plane. Although they will take 50,000 pounds, quite often you have to haul cargo that is much lighter. I mentioned earlier that the Rowan rigs are capable of being moved by Sky Crane helicopter. Atlantic Richfield and Humboldt has one of these sky cranes under charter and is using it for moving the rig around the field as well as moving other supplies. This sky crane is capable of lifting 20,000 pounds, and the rigs are designed to be moved with the crane. On our first move, we were able to completely move the rig 8.1 miles in 54 and a half flying hours. This was over a period of about 11 days. Of course, this was in the summer. It takes good flying weather and coordination of effort to move this fast, but it does work and is about the only way that you can move across the tundra in the summertime with these large loads. Another shot of the sky crane actually going across the country with a load. Now, the next few slides show the off-landing of shallow draft barges, which were used to move a major portion of our cargo to Prudhoe Bay this summer. This is on Prudhoe Bay. In the background at the top of the picture is about 20 acres, 23 acres of offloading area, storage area, a causeway coming out into the bay at 1,100 feet long. At the end of this causeway, a T-head built of four steel barges, which are sunk in position and serve as a staging area where the cranes can lift the cargo off the barges. These are shallow draft barges seen here, lightering barges. The cargo is moved around from Seattle and the Mackenzie River. The Seattle barges are deep draft barges, about 14 foot, and the cargo is lightered from the deep draft barges onto these shallow barges and brought into the bay. The bay at the end of the T-head is 4.5 or 5 feet of water. About 65,000 tons of material was hauled in this manner from Seattle to Prudhoe Bay this summer. Some of that unloading is still going on from Seattle. Costs by water are somewhat less than air transportation, but there are drawbacks to this method also in that there is a tendency to oversupply or perhaps take in supplies and materials that might not be needed. Air transportation, on the other hand, usually results in taking exactly what you need when you need it. Typical rates for tonnages delivered from Seattle to Prudhoe Bay would be $125 to $135 a ton, depending on the volume of the commitment. A second way of bringing barges to Prudhoe Bay is down the Mackenzie River from Hay River. There are another flotilla of barges bringing supplies in via the Mackenzie River route. They are just starting to arrive at Prudhoe Bay. Typical costs from Hay River to Prudhoe Bay are $90 to $100 a ton, again, depending on the size of the commitment and the terms. These aren't too good pictures here. More shots of the dock area. This shows a shallow draft tug taking the lightering barge into the dock. This is the storage area where you'll see the pipe racks, fuel storage, cargo of all kinds in the background. This was taken about 2 weeks ago. It's much more material in there now. Again, the storage area. There are still other ways of hauling cargo to the North Slope and moving it around the slope once it is there. There are proposals for hovercraft and hovercraft trailers. The hovercraft has been used successfully by some seismic crews this summer. A few of the companies have used large, low-bearing, Nodwell-type vehicles to haul some equipment. And, of course, as has been mentioned, the winter road was used to some extent last winter by the industry. Cost comparisons are very elusive on the North Slope. It is necessary to compare not only the mode of transportation, but the timing, the cost of the material at the originating point, and the length of term of the commitment. For example, 1 ton of casing manufactured in Pittsburgh, delivered to the North Slope by 3 different routes, can result in substantially different costs to the user depending on the route chosen. If its final destination were Prudhoe Bay, it may be the cheapest route would be to rail the pipe to Hay River, move it down the Mackenzie to the Prudhoe Bay dock. This hypothetically might cost $170 a ton. The same ton of casing going to the Seattle point of embarkation and delivered by barge around to Prudhoe Bay might cost $175 a ton. Flying this same ton of casing from Fairbanks to the North Slope by Hercules after a rail trip to Fairbanks could result in a cost of $270 a ton, $100 per ton higher. Obviously, the way the purchasing agent or traffic manager would recommend would be by the Hay River barge route. However, if the decision to move the material is delayed and the casing not ordered quite in time to make the barge delivery, it may force the material to be hauled by air. In this case, the time of the year enters into the logistics. There are just certain 6-week period that you can get material into the Prudhoe Bay by the water route. Also, if it were necessary to drill the well or use the material at a distance away from Prudhoe Bay, maybe 40 or 50 miles, the cost of barging the pipe to Prudhoe Bay plus trucking it or cat training it or sky craning it from that point out to the well site might well end up being more than the cost of flying the pipe directly to the well site from Fairbanks via Hercules. Each method of transportation has its advantages and disadvantages. It's up to the user to evaluate these various approaches and try to arrive at the most economical one for his particular case. Of course, any lead time that can be given the supplier or carrier can often result in a tremendous economic savings by using the appropriate carrier. In my opinion, we will see the continued utilization of all of the present forms of surface, air, and water transportation, at least for the next 2 or 3 years. It may be that by then, one mode of transportation will break through far enough ahead of the others to gain the competitive advantage. But at this time, all of them have their place and can be used. If carefully considered and planned, the method chosen can be of great economic advantage to the user. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. We have coffee prepared at this time, and we'll have a 15-minute coffee break. Would you please be back in here in 15 minutes? There are a few announcements to be made before the beginning of the session again. There will tonight, in the section on oceanography and ocean engineering, in the School of Mines Auditorium, which is the second building over, be an additional paper. This will be a paper at the end of the others. The topic of the paper will be Northern Transportation Research at the University of Calgary by Mr. Walker and Norrie. Mr. Walker is Professor of Mechanical Engineering, Mr. Norrie, Professor and Head of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Calgary. There are a number of messages at the message booth outside, and I'm going to read off a list of names here. Some of these are apparently fairly urgent, and I will probably mispronounce half of these names, so I'll be happy to spell it out if any of you think that your name has been at least closely approximated. Mr. Yamashita, Dr. Elizabeth Power, Mr. Wanick, Mr. Barbridge, Mr. Chancey Croft, Miss Siemens, L. Siemens, Dr. John Lee, Richard Montague, and Ed Crittenden. Now being coffeed and messaged, we can continue. The next speaker on our program is Mr. David Henderson. You'll notice here that we have representatives from Atlantic Richfield, British Petroleum, and finally Humboldt. Mr. Henderson is the project site representative for the Trans-Alaska Pipe System, and he is resident in Anchorage. Mr. Henderson received his Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering degree from the University of London in 1944. I can imagine what doing homework in London was like about 1942 or 43. Following graduation, Mr. Henderson went with the Ministry of Aircraft Production, and then following that, worked for a contracting firm, and I am hard-pressed here to read the name of the firm, so I won't try. He then went with British Petroleum in 1948 and has been with them ever since. He's been engaged primarily in construction projects for BP in the Middle East, Australia, United Kingdom, and now finally in Alaska. Mr. Henderson.